Yes, good morning. Come on in, have a seat. We're going to get started. First, I want to thank you all for the work you do. Wherever you are working, whether you're working for Mosberg or an FQHC or the university, you're doing work that is difficult and important. Sort of the theme of my presentation about pharmacotherapy of addictions. SBIRT, to me, doesn't mean screening, brief intervention, and referral to treatment. Isn't it strange that alcohol and drug problems are the only diseases that don't belong in usual healthcare settings? At the University Hospital, there are two physicians who are board certified in addiction medicine as of last December. Well, we got our boards for it in April, I think. If you have an alcohol or a drug problem, you need to go across town. And if you have poorly controlled diabetes, oh, come in. We have this wonderful diabetes center. It's right on the hospital lobby. More on that as we go. But these are becoming medical diseases. And what do I mean by that? Oh, I'm going to have to find, here we go. Have you all heard those sentiments? That's done with. Addictions and probably hazardous use are chronic brain diseases. They are chronic brain diseases just as much as epilepsy is a chronic brain, or epilepsies are chronic brain diseases. You know, a couple of hundred years ago, everybody thought that, if you had seizures, you were being seized by some demon. And what do we think now? They are chronic brain diseases. What do we do to treat them? Medications. Hello? Addictions are chronic brain diseases. That's the theme song of Nora Volkow, who is the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. www.drugabuse.gov. It's not where you go to learn how to abuse drugs, but it's wonderful. So ESPR is screening, brief intervention, referral, and treatment. I'm a family doc at heart. Yeah, I'm addiction medicine, but I'm a family doc. We have the power of the prescription. How many of you can write prescriptions for non-controlled drugs anyway? So a few. How many of you work with somebody who has the power of the prescription? You have a job. I want you to proselytize. Yeah, proselytize is a dirty word in our sort of a-religious culture. But what proselytize really means is taking the alien and making them kin. Making them part of the family. These are diseases we can treat with medications. That's what I'm going to talk about. Don't forget that brief interventions treat hazardous use and more complex psychosocial treatments treat both hazardous use and addiction. Number needed to treat of 8 to 9. More on that in a moment. We all have the power of words. The power of words. Remember that. You first have to diagnose these problems. You have to find out they are there. When I talk to medical audiences, I always use the analogy of high blood pressure. If a patient walks in, I don't know if they have hypertension. Oh, I can look at you. I can see you. You have hypertension. Hello? No? We scream. The last time you went to get health care, anywhere, family doc, gynecologist, ER, surgeon, well, maybe not a psychiatrist, but didn't they check your blood pressure? What are they doing? They're checking a vital sign because they want to know if you're alive or not. That's what vital means. So if you had measurable blood pressure, you were alive. It was a sign of vitality. Like, okay, we screen. And how do you screen for alcohol and drug problems? The questions are on your handout. We can talk about those later. Pharmacotherapy. First, tobacco. It's easy to screen. Do you smoke or use tobacco? Nicotine replacement therapy, just, over-the-counter stuff, doubles the success rate in quitting smoking. And I was reminded just yesterday, insurance companies don't pay for these. Because, if this person wanted to quit smoking, they could do it. Right? When I talk to patients and I say, do you smoke? If the answer is yes, my next question, what are your thoughts about quitting? Or if I'm in a playful mood and I kind of know the patient, I'll say, any chance of getting you to quit? I never ask, how much do you smoke? Well, sometimes I do. I don't really care if they are 2 packs a day or a half a pack a day. They smoke. They ought to quit. That's the important thing. So go to what's important. Do you smoke? Yes. What are your thoughts about quitting? And one of the most common responses, I'd like to, but I can't. I would love to see a commercial, like Super Bowl commercial. Anybody here got a spare $10 million? Just showing a little clip of a conversation. Do you smoke? Yes. Hey, what are your thoughts about quitting? I'd like to, but I can't. And then just rapid fire. Different people. As much diversity as you can get. Just every one of them saying, I'd like to, but I can't, 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 but I can't. Nicotine replacement therapy doubles the success rate in quitting smoking. Use enough. That's the biggest mistake we make. We tell people to keep the dose low. If you're pregnant, oh, don't use nicotine replacement. They're smoking. What is that? It's a nicotine delivery system. A very fast, high-dose nicotine delivery system. They're engineered to do that. And menthol, which is also addicting, especially for kids. Menthol is in cigarettes because it reduces the irritation from the smoke, making it easier to get the new user addicted, i.e. customer for life. Shortened, but for life. Use enough nicotine. Two of the Nicoderm 21 patches, if necessary. If they start with one and they're still wanting to smoke, put on two. Use enough. Bupropion. Hard word to say. Yeah, that's why we like trade names. This is why pharmaceutical manufacturers come up with nice names like Wellbutrin. That doubles the success rate in quitting smoking. The only serious side effect is it lowers the seizure threshold, making seizures more likely. So if somebody has an active seizure disorder, even if well controlled, I avoid bupropion. And maybe if somebody has had serious head injury, I mean like traumatic brain injury, might be good to avoid it. And it's just the standard dose that we use for depression. 150 once a day for a few days, let the body kind of get used to it, and then twice a day. Varenicline, Chantix. Enchanting trade name. That at least doubles the success rate. Some studies, it quadruples the success rate in quitting smoking. What's interesting is half of the standard dose works not quite as well, perhaps, but it works pretty well. It doubles the success rate anyway, and it's a lot cheaper because the pharmacist can get the bottle of 1,000 pills, 1 milligram pills, and the patient gets a pill splitter, and they take a half a pill in the morning with breakfast and a half a pill in the evening with supper. Taking it with food because nausea is one of its common side effects. It is said to create depression and suicidal risk, and probably not. Quitting smoking increases the suicide risk. Quitting smoking is hard and depressing. But yeah, stay in touch with the patient.
Dr. Vincent.
Yes. Oh, I want to, it's got to warm up for a day or two. Let's see, does this work? Yeah.
My question is, well, one thing that you didn't have here as a side effect for Chantix is weight gain. And I've tried several of those things that you had up there. And
yeah.
Chantix, I can say that it actually did work, yet within like a month. And this was not from increasing food. I gained like 50 pounds.
No. Yeah. Yeah, it is. Any drug can do anything to anybody. That's not a very common side effect of Chantix. Nausea is more common. But you know, when patients tell me they had a problem, I just say, oh, we got to try something else. You know, but it's a reason. We're talking reasons why making cigarette packages ugly, raising the tobacco tax in Missouri, which is a shameful, way cheapest in the country. The next cheapest is like four times as much. I think that's South Carolina. The median in the country is 7 or 8 times what Missouri's tax is. Why am I talking that way? Because if you do those things, kids will be less likely to start smoking. This is an addiction where prevention matters, and it's a public health problem. You all probably know all of this stuff. Hopefully you believe that brief interventions do work. I mean, I have talked with alcoholics. Granted, it wasn't a brief intervention. Well, almost. I spent about half an hour talking with this guy, but he cut down. He was drinking 8 to 10 drinks 4 or 5 nights a week, was regularly driving after drinking. And when I saw him back a month later, he was drinking no more than 2, and he was never driving after drinking. Oh, it's delightful. What medications help? There are many. Naltrexone, probably the one with the best evidence of efficacy. How many of you have worked with a patient or client who was given naltrexone? I'm glad to see those hands. This is a drug we need to use more of. One of my patients is a mental health professional. I saw him night before last, evening clinic. He's been in this field. He goes around training people. And I better be careful. Some of you might guess who this is. No, I'm sure none of you know. Never heard of naltrexone. Never heard of it. It works. 50 milligram pill, a half a pill a day for maybe 4 days, and then go up to 1 a day. Again, take it with food. The biggest problem with this drug is it's an opioid blocker. And when it was first shown to work in reducing drinking, it was something of a mystery. Why would an opioid antagonist that blocks the mu receptors on brain cells, why would that help people cut down or quit drinking? That was 20 years ago, and now some of the complexities of those brain pathways have been figured out. So we know a little bit more, but because it's an opioid antagonist, if a patient is being treated with naltrexone, they're not drinking, they fall down their stairs and they break their neck. Fortunately, this guy did not have a spinal cord injury, and no, he had not been drinking. His blood alcohol when he got to the ED was 0. But treating his pain was hard. It took huge doses of IV morphine to control his pain. It was possible, but it just isn't easy. It's not cheap. $350 a day. I bet you all know people who spend more than $3.50 on alcoholic beverages. The injection, Vivitrol, might work better. IM Vivitrol once every 4 weeks versus having somebody take the naltrexone tablet in front of their spouse or partner or roommate. And the roommate watches this person take the naltrexone each day and says, "Thank you." End of conversation. You don't talk about alcohol anymore for 24 hours. That's sort of what the patient gets back for giving up that autonomy, that, privacy. They haven't been compared head-to-head. The shot is expensive. $1,200 a shot is what our pharmacy charges for it. The manufacturer, www.vivitrol.com, You have to drill down a step or two, but you can find a coupon there that you can print out, and the manufacturer will cover up to $500 of the copay. Anybody have any experience with a drug court mandating IM naltrexone once a month? Anybody? Yeah, it's not common, but if I were a judge dealing with a problem drinker, I mean, you know, somebody who's been convicted of drunk driving for their fifth time, you know, you can either go to prison for 8 years and come out and go back to drinking, or we can try to treat you. You're going to take antabuse every day. You're going to take this shot once a month, and we are going to watch. We're going to make sure you're doing those things. Now, naltrexone, number needed to treat, 9. You're going to see that number a bit. The number needed to treat, I'm a simple-minded doc. What it is how many people do I have to write a prescription for naltrexone for, and they take it? That's the challenge sometimes. How many people do I have to treat for one person to benefit? 9. It's calculated by 1 divided by the risk difference. And it can be the outcome in the control group minus the outcome in the intervention group, or the other way around, depending on whether you're talking about a benefit or a bad outcome. Number needed to treat of 9. It's not a wonder drug. It's not the best number needed to treat you're going to see. But think about it this way. This might be helpful when you're trying to convince physicians that naltrexone's worth using. Yes, I'm asking you to change society. Yes.
Does it take 9 to be treated for one person to benefit because of compliance?
Does it take 9 to be treated for one to benefit because of compliance? These are data from randomized trials. Randomized trials enroll people who are much more compliant than the people you and I deal with. But it's just measuring how many people did well in the naltrexone group, how many people did well in the placebo group. Compare those two rates. Any physician you talk with will know that if somebody is at high risk of a stroke or a heart attack, they need to be on some statin. My favorite is pravastatin, because it's on Walmart's $4 list and it doesn't have a lot of interactions. Now, this is a somewhat complex slide. I love using this. It's a screenshot of an Excel spreadsheet. And I love doing this with a patient. This is just an example. A man who is 50, whose total cholesterol is 250 and whose HDL is only 35. Those are really bad cholesterol numbers, but they're not rare. On treatment for hypertension, blood pressure 135, and yes, this guy smokes. If I had the actual spreadsheet up here, I'd show you what changing smoking yes to a no would do. That red bar would look, and I've had patients look at that and say, wow, sort of, oh, you mean if I quit smoking? Yes, if you quit smoking, our cardiology colleagues think you can lower that red bar within maybe a few weeks. 29% risk of having a stroke or a heart attack in the next 10 years. If I treat that patient with a statin, I can lower that risk by about a third. One-third of 29%, let's keep the math easy, 10%. 1 divided by 10%, I can improve the outcome for 10% of the people. You know, what this is saying is that of 100 people just like this guy, 29 of them are going to have a stroke or a heart attack in the next 10 years. 71 won't, whether they take a statin or not. But for about 10 of those people, taking a statin will mean they won't have a stroke or a heart attack instead of yes, they will. We don't know which 10, of course. Number needed to treat, 1 divided by 10%, 10. And there is not a doctor in Missouri who would say, oh no, it's a bad idea to treat that patient with a statin. It's crazy.
Insurance covers it.
Pardon?
Insurance will cover that.
Oh, yeah, insurance. You know, I've had insurance companies send me a letter saying, why isn't this patient on a statin? And I say, well, I've tried 5 of them, and she had muscle aches and won't take any of them. Poor lady. A camphorsate, not as commonly used, works a lot better in Europe than it does in the United States. I don't know why. A little more expensive, no generic. You have to take it 3 times a day. If you've ever tried to take a medicine 3 times a day, you know how hard that is. It's actually easier to take it 4 times a day if you eat regularly, if you can take it with food. The nice thing about acamprosate, it's okay with liver disease. So if you have an alcoholic who's got bad liver disease, acamprosate is a reasonable option. There's another opioid antagonist that isn't available in the U.S. yet, but it works probably as well as naltrexone, and it doesn't hurt the liver. So I'm hoping that will come to market soon. One of the biggest problems, I think, with acamprosate, you're taking 2 333-milligram pills. Why they didn't make them 330 or 335, I don't know. But think about taking 666 3 times a day. You know. The number needed to treat? 9. And just like as with tobacco, treating tobacco addiction doesn't help to use nicotine replacement plus bupropion plus Chantix. Any mix of those doesn't do you any more good than any one by itself. Likewise here. Use naltrexone or acamprosate. There's no evidence, and it's been studied in one huge randomized trial, no evidence that using them together improves outcomes. This is more hypothesis, post hoc analysis of which people did well with acamprosate and which people did well with naltrexone. With naltrexone, the outcome was more often reduction in heavy drinking. And with acamprosate, it was more often maintenance of abstinence. So, that's hypothesis. It's not scientifically proven fact, but it's still somewhat helpful. There are a lot of other medicines with weaker evidence, like Topamax. One or two randomized trials that have shown that it worked. I think one that showed it didn't, so I don't know. It's more complex. You don't just start with naltrexone. You start a half a pill a day for 4 days and then a whole pill from there on out. Acamprosate is 333, 2 of those 3 times a day from day 1. Topiramate, start at 25 and gradually over a few weeks you ramp it up to 200 milligrams a day, maybe 300. The tablets can be split, but what's inside is unstable. So my pharmacist colleague says, don't split them. It's not a good idea. Cognitive slowing, that's why a street name for this medication is Dopamax. Dysgeusia, I love that word. It means taste perversion. It really makes things taste weird. So lots of patients don't like that. And that's why topiramate is half of some combination with phentermine, I think, as a weight loss medication. Because this drug cuts down appetite and makes things taste weird, so it's easier to eat less. Antabuse, good old drug, almost as old as I am. It doesn't work because it's too easy to say, I'm not drinking anymore, I don't need this medication. You stop taking it and what do you know, 3 days later. And so what one of the folks who first tried this out and showed that it worked coined it antabuse assurance. It's again, my roommate, my partner, my spouse watches me take it every day, says thank you, and as Wynn was just pointing out to me, then you might get into a bit of conversation if that couple are in couples therapy and the spouse or partner has learned how to do motivational interviewing, not nagging. That's a skill. Alcoholism and depression commonly occur together. One clinical trial, fascinating, very well done study, four groups. Naltrexone by itself, Zoloft by itself, both medications for both placebos. So everybody took two pills. Are they two placebos or two active drugs? Patient doesn't know. The combination worked better, not only at cutting down drinking, but at improving depression. The depression got better with both medications than it did with sertraline by itself, same dose. So keep that in mind. One clinical trial, but number needed to treat of three or four. That's good. I don't know too many therapies that are that efficacious. But keep in mind that it's very common for the first published randomized trial to say, wow! And then the next study, just like it, well, not so good. That's what made the first naltrexone trial so impressive, published 20 years ago this year. Two different groups, very similar study designs, very similar outcomes, published back to back in the same issue of some prestigious medical journal. I think we can say naltrexone really works. Now, for alcohol withdrawal, I want you all to know about gabapentin, Neurontin, for treating withdrawal. Again, one randomized trial, but it worked. 400 milligrams three times a day. Just start with 400 milligrams three times a day. Many of my colleagues are very shy about treating people with gabapentin. They start really low, like 300 milligrams once a day. No, 400 milligrams three times a day worked better than Ativan, lorazepam, with fewer side effects, And what was especially intriguing, the post hoc finding of, oh, the people we gave gabapentin to were less likely to relapse to heavy drinking. And if you send them home with gabapentin and they take the medication and they continue to drink, no big harm done. But if you send them home with a benzodiazepine and they continue to drink, harm done. So for outpatients, gabapentin is the drug of first choice. I'll treat outpatient withdrawal with a benzo only when I can give the prescription to the spouse or partner in the room. And I say, you control this medication. And if she is drinking, don't give her this Ativan. Just don't do it. Maybe I'm too much a nihilist. Methamphetamine, harder. We're getting down to the single randomized clinical trial findings. Keep in mind what I just said. The first trial that's published, wow. And subsequent trials, often not as good. Mirtazapine, Remeron, good old antidepressant, 30 milligrams once a day. It worked, judging by urines that were negative for methamphetamine once a week. Easy drug to take, sedation, and the munchies are the two side effects. Marijuana, N-acetylcysteine. N-acetylcysteine is available over the counter as a supplement. Most pharmacies don't stock it because it's not commonly used. And the reason it isn't commonly used, that medication smells like rotten eggs. It's what people in the ED get if they come in with a Tylenol overdose. N-acetylcysteine. They are made to drink it. Yes, drink. Ugh. That'll teach you to try to, yeah. Such kindness. No, Mark Borenstein would never yell at a patient who came in with a suicidal attempt. ED physicians are kinder than that. Well done study. They gave the research participants their pills in blister packs, and to blind those on placebo, they dusted the inside of the blister pack with N-acetylcysteine, so it stunk like rotten eggs. But in this study, they also use contingency management. This is what you can do if you have a grant. You pay people $5 just to come in. Not only was the visit at no cost to them, they got paid to come in. We don't do that in healthcare routinely. Maybe we should. And they got paid another $5 if their urine was negative for marijuana. So it works. The authors of the article did not say what the number needed to treat was. I just looked at this graph and I guessed it's about 7. That's pretty good, but that again is with really full court press contingency management, which I wish we could do more of. Maybe some of you could teach me how. But it did seem to help some people. Remember, marijuana is not the most dangerous drug. Recreational use is now legal in 2 states, although if they are part of the United States, it's not legal. It'll be interesting to see how that all gets worked out, if it ever does. But what I tell patients, you know, marijuana is not the world's most dangerous drug. I don't stress out about it. But it's not the world's safest drug. Marijuana use doubles or triples
a person's risk of developing schizophrenia, not a benign outcome. And that's the conclusion of researchers who did a meta-analysis of huge cohort studies and Swedish study comparing army draftees who used marijuana and who didn't, and what happened to them over the subsequent years. But those researchers were in Holland, where marijuana is sold in coffee shops.
Remember the age of that? The age range of the population?
Most of the cohort studies looked at adolescents and young adults. So does that apply to older people? Oh, I'm extrapolating if I apply it to older people. But I really don't think marijuana is benign.
Why don't you talk about the cancer, the carcinogens?
The risk of...
Versus the... I'm just wondering why you think of that yourself.
The question of whether marijuana ought to be legalized, there are some studies that say it helps chronic pain and lots of things. I use the analogy there of digitalis. Now it's made in factories, digoxin, but it originally came from foxglove, a particular species, I guess, of foxglove, pretty little wildflower. I wish I had a picture of it. And centuries ago, people knew they could treat dropsy, basically severe swelling all over, with foxglove leaves, dried, ground up as a powder, and you just swallow it. Okay, granted, some people died because they got too much of the alkaloids in foxglove. There are many chemically active, neurologically, or cardiologically active compounds in foxglove. And if you take dried out foxglove leaves, you don't know how much you're getting. You don't know what combination of alkaloids you're ingesting. Same with marijuana. There are varieties of marijuana that have been, cultivated by horticulturalists, just like, the Green Revolution, before there were gene transfers to make Roundup-ready soybeans. You take the plant that seems to be most like what you want, and you grow it, and you select its descendants that are even more like what you want, and you just keep doing that. You can do it with lab rats, too. That's why we have alcoholic rats. Yes, they were developed. Rats who preferred alcohol over water. But there are strains of marijuana that have been developed that have none of the psychoactive cannabinoids. So people don't get high from it. So my hope is that somebody is going to come up with derivatives of marijuana, just like they've come up with derivatives of foxglove. So now when I prescribe digoxin, it's a precise dose. I know what I'm giving, and I can measure the blood level of it. And I also know who is more likely to benefit. It's not everybody. So I'm hoping that somebody will come up with a derivative of marijuana that can be taken maybe as a pill that helps chronic pain without increasing the risk of schizophrenia or the risk of lung cancer. Yes, inhaling an unfiltered cigarette is not good for your lungs. And frequent smoking of marijuana does increase lung cancer risk. Now, I don't have as pretty a picture as Wynn did of the brain, but this is awfully complex. And I tried to cram all of this stuff in before I took that addiction medicine board exam in December, and like everything I've ever crammed, I have forgotten it. Number needed to treat, I look at this graph and I really can't say. The black bars are gabapentin and the gray bars are placebo, and okay, it looks like there's a difference, p-value of 0.004, but it sure doesn't look like a wonder drug to me. Cocaine, even less evidence. N-acetylcysteine might help, and there are preliminary studies only, like in laboratory rats. You can get a rat addicted to cocaine pretty easily. It's harder to get a rat addicted to alcohol because usual lab rats won't drink alcohol. They agree with me. I've never met an alcoholic beverage I could stand the taste of. Why am I in addiction medicine? I don't know. Lots of drugs, but don't take these home. You know, we don't have pharmacotherapy for addiction, but we do for opioid addiction. The drug I want to make sure you know about is buprenorphine. How many of you work in a place where there is at least one physician certified to prescribe Suboxone? I hope that in a year or two, all of you will be. Take this information to your physician colleagues. And I emphasize the word physician because the federal law that allows docs like me to prescribe buprenorphine, the law says physicians, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants can't by federal law, which doesn't make any sense to me. Missouri doesn't allow nurse practitioners to prescribe controlled drugs, which doesn't make sense to me either. But, I mean, you know, come on. Insulin is more dangerous than opioids. Far more. But when I have a patient with poorly controlled diabetes, it's one of the nurse practitioners I turn to because she knows a heck of a lot more about it than I do. Okay, buprenorphine. Just got to be aware that there is a ceiling on its effects. 8 milligram film or tablet. Take 1, you take 2, you take 3, you take 4, you take 10, you take 100. You're against the ceiling. It doesn't do any more for you or to you. The only people who die of buprenorphine overdose are opioid-naive little people. Think toddler. Toddler gets a hold of one of mom's Suboxone in the ED, or maybe dies. That's why the manufacturer of Suboxone puts every film in its own little childproof pouch. Nice little diversion. Interesting bit of sociology here. Suboxone, trade name, is made by Reckitt Benckiser. And Reckitt Benckiser makes only one prescription drug, Suboxone. But I'm willing to bet, and I'm not a betting man, that every one of you have products in your household made by Reckitt Benckiser. Lysol, Calgon dishwashing detergent, Airwick air freshener, French's mustard, the list goes on. There's a Reckitt Benckiser factory on I-44, just this side of Springfield, French's mustard, made in Missouri. Buprenorphine, very potent opioid. That 8-milligram film, 300-400 milligrams of morphine equivalent. That's strong. Buprenorphine plus naloxone, trade name Suboxone. They put the naloxone in there, which does nothing under the tongue. Doesn't get absorbed. Zip. But it's in there because if you take that Suboxone and dissolve it and inject it, then the naloxone goes to work. Trade name Narcan. IV Narcan is a pure antagonist to opioids, and it'll throw them into withdrawal very quickly. Like one of my patients said, I should have listened to you. It was just like you said, oh, that was terrible. It's expensive. $8 a film and 2-3 a day. We're talking $500, $700, $800 a month. That's expensive. Generics are just coming to market. The price hasn't come down that much yet, but it will. Side effects, constipation. All opioids cause constipation. Tolerance to that does not develop, unfortunately. So you just have to get smart about laxatives. It can make migraines worse. Just keep that in mind. And the treatments for migraines still work, so they can stay on their buprenorphine. Under the tongue, because like nitroglycerin, if you swallow it, it doesn't work because the liver chews it up. You know, blood from the gut carrying all of the nutrients that we eat goes to the liver first. The liver is a factory, and it destroys buprenorphine. First time through, first pass metabolism. And my patients have all told me it tastes terrible. I've never tasted it. I don't want to. Many of you are mental health professionals. And I put this information up there not because I want to diss you. You're far too important. Far too important. Because the drug use is not the only problem in these people's lives. And they need a lot of help to rebuild their lives. Abstinence is important, but they need a lot more in addition to that. But this was a randomized trial of counseling once a week versus no counseling. They just came in, saw the doc, got their week's supply of Suboxone. That was all. Yeah. While they were taking the medication, 49% stayed clean, with or without counseling. The researchers were very disappointed in that. And then after 3 months, the Suboxone was tapered away, as the study was designed. And when the drug had been stopped, with or without counseling, that 49% dropped to 9%. Number needed to treat equals 1 divided by 49% minus 9%. 1 divided by 40%, 2.5. Insurance companies still don't believe this because it's an expensive drug. And so Missouri Medicaid just this week has forced one of my patients to either buy her own Suboxone. She's been clean for 3 years. And they say it's time for her to get off this. Now, granted, this was a 3-month trial. There haven't been studies of 1 year 3 years. So, would she do all right if we tapered her? We're going to find out, because she can't afford it. And my fear is that as I taper her down, pushed down by the insurance, she might relapse. And one trip to the ED with hospitalization will cost them a lot more than a year or two or five of buprenorphine. Oh, yeah. Getting off it may be difficult unless the insurance company tells you to. Although it's interesting, I love quoting this, and I have it on my laptop. If you want to see it, I can pull it up. The current federal guideline, 2005, but SAMHSA has not come out with a new edition of their treatment improvement protocol for the office-based treatment of opioid addiction. They say on page 58, and I can show you the PDF, that maintenance therapy with buprenorphine, quote, may be indefinite, close quote. If SAMHSA says it may be indefinite, Dan Benson isn't going to argue with that. When the science comes out that says after a year, it makes no difference whether they stay on it or taper off it, then I'll listen, especially if they can tell me, how do I know if this patient's going to do well or not? Yeah, you have to get this special certification to prescribe buprenorphine. I did it years ago. I've been doing this for 4.5 years, and I will be delighted to help any physician that you know who wants to get certified. You can go through the training online, free, 8 hours. It's not quick, but it can be done. Now, naltrexone again. Yeah, there was a study done in Russia. IM naltrexone versus IM sterile water. They both hurt, so it really was double blind. People given IM naltrexone were more likely to get into recovery than people given the placebo. But it hasn't been compared to buprenorphine or methadone, so I don't know. I'm not ready to go to a drug that's $1,200 a shot, but I'm wondering. I've got a few patients who don't do well, who are in that 51% who don't get clean on buprenorphine. Maybe IM naltrexone would be the way to go. Not a simple transition. Okay, that's all for me. We're going to get Wynn up here and open it to your questions. Let me bring up the microphone again. Maybe. You want to use the, this mic?
Yeah, sure. One of you can use the lavalier.
I'll work around with this if it will just start. Is it up?
Yeah.
Okay, good. All right. Tell us your, those folks who give you heartburn, and I'll see if Wynn can come up with an answer for you.
Hey, can you go?
I can. My question is, and this is the doctor, so maybe that's right. Is there any good research yet in regards to using e-cigarettes as a nicotine replacement?
E-cigarettes are, I haven't priced them, but they're not cheap. And it is a novel nicotine delivery system that mimics the activities of smoking, and it delivers some of the other junk in tobacco. It isn't just a nicotine delivery system. So I sort of see e-cigarettes as cigarettes, maybe less secondhand smoke, which harms people. Other questions?
So Any other questions just readily pop out?
Yes. Speak at the microphone too young.
I don't know if it's too much of a question, but because Suboxone, I understand folks taking that have to have therapy or some sort of substance abuse treatment, so that's interesting that it's not helpful when they have to.
The federal law says that people on buprenorphine, a physician who is prescribing it has to be able to give mental health consultation and services. I have some patients who are doing wonderfully well on buprenorphine, have been for years. They've got their lives together. Like some of them have told me, I haven't gone fishing for this comment. This drug has given me my life back. I don't think I've ever heard that when I have treated diabetes or hypertension. This drug has given me my life back. There, like one patient has been through two pregnancies on it and has done well. She's doing great with her kids and relationships with her husband is solid. But then I also have some folks who are doing poorly. Maybe they're staying off illicit opioids, but they're still using marijuana, occasional meth, drinking heavily, or maybe they're not using substances, but their lives are still in shambles. I love having wonderful mental health professionals like Catherine and Toby up here. I would love to work with any of you. Other questions? Yes.
I work with a lot of co-occurring clients.
Thank you.
And they take a lot of psychotropic meds, as well as maybe Suboxone or Vivitrol or something. Do they interact with each other, the medications?
Can you repeat it?
Yeah. Drug interactions with all of these meds that I have talked about. They can. Although, on the other hand, buprenorphine, other than its just general sedating properties, which is why Medicaid doesn't like us to treat the opioid addiction with buprenorphine and the chronic panic disorder with, say, clonazepam. But other than that, that particular drug doesn't have any problems. The big actor there is naltrexone. The very first patient that I treated with naltrexone almost 20 years ago, a woman who was an alcoholic, they said, "Oh, this new drug has just come out. It'll help you quit drinking." And I was really stupid. I was also treating her chronic pain with chronic morphine. Don't do that. But buprenorphine generally doesn't increase the risk of serotonin syndrome, so that's a real plus. Varenicline, Chantix, doesn't have any serious drug interactions, but I always think about drug interactions. And if any of you are prescribers, I hope you have drug interaction checking, ideally automatically built into your electronic medical record, or at least readily available. Other questions? Let me get the mic to you.
Naltrexone. It seems to have a reputation as something that can only be prescribed within a treatment program. Is that a myth? I mean, primary care physicians seem to rarely prescribe it.
I'm still waiting to get approval to look at the Missouri Medicaid data, de-identified, to see how often someone has a diagnosis of an alcohol use disorder and a prescription that they filled that Medicaid paid for naltrexone or a Camprosate. I've been waiting for them to give me the data for a year, and it hasn't quite happened yet. But think they are underused medications. And yes, family docs and general internists, pediatricians treating adolescents should be quick to consider naltrexone or acamprosate for those with alcohol use disorders.
Did you say should be or shouldn't?
Should be. Oh, yeah, yeah. Family docs ought to be prescribing these meds a lot more often than we are. Keep in mind the prevalence of diabetes in the United States, 8.3%. The prevalence of alcohol use disorders, DSM-4 defined, 8.5%. Which disease do we treat more often? Diabetes, even though alcohol use disorders are a little more prevalent. And that's current alcohol use disorder. That's not counting the people who got into recovery. Yes, Captain.
I'm finding more and more that we see people inpatients that have been put on Suboxone and then tapered off and then see you later because you're out, and then they have no support, nothing to do. And they're like, that was a wonder drug while I was inpatient, but now there's nobody to prescribe it for me on the outside.
Yeah, one of the things that the federal law said, a physician who is federally certified to prescribe buprenorphine can only treat 100 patients at a time. 100. I could just hear some of our diabetes experts who would say, well, I'd like to be able to help you with your diabetes, but I'm at my federal limit. Sorry. But the solution to that is to get a lot more physicians certified. It breaks my heart when I have to say no to somebody. Although 2 years ago I spent an hour in an exam room in our clinic talking with two DEA agents. I don't know if you have ever been interviewed by two federal agents at the same time, but it was, but I will say that now I go around talking about how wonderful my two personal DEA agents were. Dwayne Holzapfel and Jackie Peterson, just delightful folks. But what they wanted to see was, how do you keep track? How do you know you haven't exceeded that federal limit?
Well, how do you keep track?
In our electronic medical record, I just create a special patient list. Electronic medical records are wonderful tools. They are getting more and more useful and powerful. But the problem is, it takes time. And an electronic medical record somehow doesn't create more time in the universe.
Any suggestions for patients who don't have insurance?
Oh, those who don't have insurance. Ouch. One of my patients did have the insight to say, yeah, it's expensive, but I'm spending less on Suboxone than I was on heroin before. So, although that's one out of many. There are a couple of tricks. I have fairly often now written prescriptions for plain buprenorphine without the naloxone. That's been generic longer and it's cheaper. It's about $4 for 8 milligrams rather than 8. And people are a little, I write a prescription for 21 pills a week's worth. Or maybe they can get down to 2 a day and they do okay. So I write a prescription for 14 and several refills. But the cost of coming to see me is a real problem also. Yes.
I got two questions. Is the limitation of 100 patients due to the drug being easily diverted?
No. No. The reason for the 100 patient limit goes back 99 years. The Harrison Narcotic Act of 1914 outlawed writing prescriptions for narcotics if the patient was addicted to them. And there were physicians who were put into prison because they were treating addiction by continuing to prescribe morphine. A historical side note here. Do you all know who William Wilberforce was?
Yeah.
He was a British man, an English man, back in the early 19th century, who was a member of Parliament who worked for decades to ban slave trade in the British Empire and finally succeeded. William Wilberforce was addicted to opium. Mary Todd Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln's wife, was addicted to opium. The list goes on. Buprenorphine has a rather slower onset of action, so it's a little harder to get high on it, even if you inject straight buprenorphine. But it's not diverted nearly as often as oxycodone, Percocet, Vicodin, MS, Cotton, the list goes on. And yet any doctor with a DEA number can write a prescription for, 180 Percocet a month. Yet another question.
I've worked extensively in rehab with those who are on methadone treatment, and many told me they wanted to decrease the amount they took, yet the prescribing physician would not decrease it.
Yeah, high-wage methadone maintenance programs are much more available than they are in their four in Missouri. St. Louis, Kansas City, Springfield, and Columbia. And it's hard to get into one in Columbia. They have a waiting list. Dosing of methadone is a little... There's more art there. And what docs often do is, I'm going to give you enough methadone so that you no longer have any desire to use, don't have any craving. Or if you do use, it won't work because those opioid brain cell receptors are clogged full of methadone. Tapering off methadone is as more challenging than tapering off buprenorphine because the ceiling on buprenorphine, I have a few patients who take 32 milligrams a day, but 16 to 24, you're just about fully loaded on those brain cells. So tapering down from there is obviously a lot quicker than tapering from 160 milligrams a day of methadone. And I am not an expert in methadone maintenance. Toby, you had a question or a comment?
I did. Hearing that you're saying it's hard to get high from the Suboxone. I have heard it's got a high street value as well, so I wondered if you could explain that a little bit.
Yeah, the street value of Suboxone. Last I heard, I don't have any friends in the police department, so I don't know for sure, but the last I heard was that Suboxone sells for about $8. That's its retail cost. So, yeah, I worry a little bit that someone that I prescribe Suboxone for and Medicaid pays for might go out and sell it. If I give them a prescription for $90 and they go out and sell them for $8 a piece, that can double their SSI, more or less. I think if somebody wants to get high, they're going to go after heroin or oxycodone or something else. Yes?
I know our patients that use it, like if they have a probation officer or they want to just avoid using opioids for a while, they will buy it.
I have had a number of patients who have finally gotten in to see me to get on Suboxone, and I say, well, what opioids have you been using? Heroin, morphine, oxycodone, and they tell me, oh, I've been getting Suboxone on the street, and I make a point of never asking, where'd you buy it from? Because that is one of my patients, and I don't want to know about that. So I sort of see it as diversion, but it's also kind of making treatment more available. Yeah, go figure. And it's interesting that there are some people who are willing to pay cash to get it from an illicit source. The point about probation and parole officers. You know, POs have a wonderful power. If you come in and pee dirty, you're going to jail. So that person knows I'm on a very short leash. It's the same thing as physicians who are being monitored by the physician's health program. Which, by the way, if you ever come in contact with any healthcare professional who is having trouble with alcohol or drugs, get the physician's health program, and I think there's a similar one for nurses. I'll get them involved. Not the state board. Go to the physician's health program because they will set up a monitoring program, and if the deal there is, we can pop into your office anytime, unannounced, pee in this cup. And if it shows what it shouldn't, that letter that you signed to the state board telling them that you've got an addiction, you're going to mail it. And they can have their license jerked. I can't snap my fingers, but that quickly. Oh. Other questions? Yes, sir.
Will you cover a QTC waiver issue for those medicines?
What?
Will you cover a QTC waiver issues for those medicines?
QT prolongation?
Yes.
QT prolongation might occur at higher doses of methadone. And if I'm treating chronic pain with methadone, which I rarely do, because it is the most dangerous opioid, wild pharmacology. I'll get an EKG if I get to 80 milligrams of methadone and check that QT interval. But, you know, Celexa, citalopram, and Lexapro will prolong the QT. There are several medications that make the QT part of the EKG waves, make that longer, and if that gets too long, then they can get into really nasty rhythm.
So we have one large, you know, question for the group posed by some of the folks at Barb and Bruce.
Yeah.
This is probably in Dan's mind as well. You know, how much of this is happening at your practice sites right now where you work? How much addiction medicine is being prescribed? And if it isn't, I mean, I really, so by show of hands, how common is it? So let's just say not very common, moderately common, common practice. So just show your hand. Let's start with not very common practice.
Now, are you talking about
addiction medicine? I'm talking about anything for alcoholism, opiates, or any addiction medicine. So,
but you're talking about prescribing.
You know, talking about prescribing, where the doctors, or the nurse practitioners, or, you know, not the nurse practitioners, but the doctors, the ones are prescribing.
Well, where psychiatrists can prescribe naltrexone, nicotine replacement Chantix.
But so just, let's just raise your hand again. So, not very common practice.
Yeah.
Nicotine. Okay, let's take off nicotine, it sounds like. Let's take off nicotine. It's really important. That's just a great question. So let's just take off nicotine. So now let's go for other substances. So not very common practice for right here. So maybe about 35-40%. So now, moderately common practice to do it, only about like 3%, 4 or 5%.
Yeah.
And now very common practice to prescribe. All right, so there was a bunch that didn't respond. So there's some non-responding practice.
About 90. We count back here about 90%.
Not doing it.
Not common practice.
Right, so the question that I have as a psychologist is, you know, why isn't that happening? So we can pose that to Dan, but I pose it to all of you to really get your responses.
Yeah.
I have my thoughts about it, but so let's just get some responses about that. So why aren't people prescribing routinely? He's shown the efficacy rates of these great interventions, particularly when they're coupled with psychosocial interventions or even psychosocial meds. So why isn't it happening? So now let's, why do you think, what are the top reasons why it's not happening?
I'm too busy. As a practitioner says, I'm too busy. I have a 10-minute, 15-minute slot. I'm dealing with their diabetes or their heart. I don't want to speak to them.
You need to get the mic.
Yeah, I'm too busy.
Docs say I'm too busy. Yes. All I have is 10 minutes.
I don't have time.
Yeah, who's next? I'm going to start here since I got the mic.
So I would say the too busy is one, but then the other confusing thing for me, because I take care of a number of people who have serious mental illness, is whose court is it in? You know, sometimes I'm having the psychiatrist prescribing, you know, the naltrexone or Ambien, and they're coming to me, and, you know, it's who's going to manage the meds? You know, I always feel like if I'm going to start Chantix, I have to double check with them, and I have a really hard time getting psychiatrists to return my calls.
So somewhat confusing, and just the treatment plan and the teaming around it is confusing.
I'd say outside the comfort zone, outside the feeling that's not really their scope of practice, and they haven't had the training.
It might not be efficacious. Not only outside the comfort zone, but it might not be effective.
Our clinic has a policy that states they will not prescribe any type of controlled substance for long-term use like that.
Okay, well, so not only that, I mean, I think there is a myth that you don't give, quote-unquote, addicts, you don't give them substances to get them into recovery. So I think there's a general cultural myth that fights even the notion of prescribing medications, right, that that's not how people find recovery. They don't need another substance. You know, they'll get addicted to that. And you hear that in the general public, whether doctors believe that patients
hear.
Yeah.
I
understand
if I'm just
I think our doctors tend to focus on those kind of quality measures that they're supposed to follow, sort of, you know, dictated cardiovascular disease, diabetes, you know, so that's really where they're measured, so that's where they focus.
So the regimen and the outcomes that they assure their quality within their healthcare system aren't there for addiction medicine, so it's not part of the protocol, which not only is it not educated, but it's also not part of the protocol.
Ours were very elected due to Vivitrol and slightly liver enzymes. There was minimally
elevated. Right, so any reason not to prescribe is blown out of proportion, and Dan said this well, and he's made comments about it throughout his talk, but any reason not to prescribe is, you know, is really seen as a reason to not do any of them, right, because they're all risky. Like, that's a general psychological phenomenon.
So we started doing ESPERT a year ago, and I would say my eyes have been open to patients. I had no idea I had any issues. So I think it's in the general provider population, just complete ignorance and unawareness. So now it's a matter of following that up.
So demand may increase just because the general notion of addiction is increased.
Oh, no space for people. So primary care refers to specialists. Specialists get in and date it. You can't get in for 3 months, then you don't go to the appointments, and then the cycle all over again.
Yeah. So there's some system dynamics just in general that make it hard. So have you seen a study on this that talks about why the general practitioners, physicians in family medicine don't prescribe?
The most common reason cited is I don't have time.
So you guys picked that up right away, and that was what we said.
Yeah. And yet, This gives me great sadness. I say to docs, what do you do if you're seeing somebody, let's say, for their diabetes? And they come in and their blood pressure is 160 over 100. That's not normal. What do you do?
Take the time.
You make time at that visit. And I'd like to work with you about your diabetes, but we also have your high blood pressure. And actually, getting their blood pressure better and getting them on a statin will do more for their health than getting their A1C better. But docs will make time when they need to.
Yeah, so I thought I had a comment on you.
So my one comment to what you just said is,
so my awareness that people have these issues now allows me to make better traction on the fact that their A1C and blood pressure has been horrible and I'm not making any progress tossing any more meds to them. So if I realize that their substance use is standing in the way, I'm going to have a much better effect for those 10 or 15 minutes I have with them addressing the real issue.
Right. So the question is, what can you do in your practice to ramp this up and be an effective change agent? Because if you're part of ESPRIT, that's sort of what ESPRIT does best, right? That's what this grant is showing you all. And this is going to continue. This is going to discontinue, right? Because we're going to create more demand for this service. So I just ask all of you, is it a matter of education and time? So maybe there's some quick publication, one pagers you can put out that show how much time you save. So we know in trauma studies this is happening, right? Because it's actually required now. And that's because there was a revolving door. These things were connected, and in your video, you're showing that one-to-one, why people are coming in for trauma. How do you make it urgent? How do you become a change agent? Maybe Dan will speak to that, how they can. How can you, without being disrespectful to the medical physician who's prescribing, how can you sort of, using motivational interviewing, suggest that create a discrepancy so that they actually might go, maybe I should get bupsortified, or maybe I should, you could look at how many patients have opiate disorders in the patient population at that practice, right?
Yeah,
give individual feedback for your own patient numbers, I think.
The way I try to influence my colleagues is, hey, come on, you jerk, you're not seeing it. isn't that what we're supposed to do?
This grant has pretty good effect.
I have two suggestions. The first just occurred to me when Wynn was having you.
Talk into the microphone. Speak into the microphone.
I gotta really love this microphone.
Yeah, I'm a little strange.
When Wynn was having you raise your hands, the question was, folks in my practice do treat tobacco addiction. They're prescribing bupropion and Chantix and nicotine replacement therapy. Well, just extend that same model. You're comfortable prescribing Chantix, even though it's a little bit tricky. Well, get comfortable prescribing naltrexone. Take them one at a time. The second thing, substance use problems are chronic disorders. When I see a patient who, surprise, has a blood pressure of 160 over 100, I don't drop everything, do a brief intervention on their hypertension, and then never measure their blood pressure again. Here, take a pill every day for the rest of your life. Talk about behavior change. We treat it as a chronic problem, and that's what we need to do with all substance use problems. Hazardous drinking to the most severe addiction. They're chronic diseases, they're not acute. So if the screen is positive, it doesn't mean I've got to stop what I'm doing, do a brief intervention. Tell them to go to Phoenix programs and good luck. No, I say, well, I noticed that we screen positive for risky drinking. Would it be okay if we spent some more time next time talking about that? Would you be willing to keep track of how much you drink? Just, you know, there's an iPhone app that, you know, what is it called? Beer Coaster or something. But there are ways to do it. You just carry a card and write down with a pen. I had two beers tonight. I had a fifth of liquor. And just bring that back with you. That's what we do with high blood pressure. That patient was 160 over 100. I don't put them on a pill right then. I say, here's a card. I'd like you to keep track of your blood pressure. You can go to Walmart. They have a machine. And just measure your blood pressure once or twice a week. Write them down and come back in a month or 6 weeks. It's a chronic problem. The biggest problem in primary care is time. We don't have enough time in a visit. The biggest asset we have in primary care is time. We see people back. I have one of my patients is in the hospital now. He's been my patient for 20 years, and I've lived in Columbia only 25. We can see people over and over and over. And yeah, that guy finally, after drinking a case of beer a day for years, I got him to cut down to just 2 6-packs. Last November, he quit. So eventually we work.
Okay, I'm not quite sure how best to word this, so you may have to help me with it. But one of the things that I've seen is that it gets a little confusing. We know that these issues are chronic, that relapse is expected. However, you know, medication is prescribed, there's controlled substances for a variety of things. Patient comes in, the doctor will drug test them. The drug test is not what it should ought to be. However, we know that that's almost to be, in some ways, expected. And then, after just a time or two, they're just dismissed, as opposed to treated. I'm wondering if that's something other people see, or and how to address it. I don't know. I've talked to the doctors about this many times and said, for example, why do we even give them pain medication if we know they're going to build a tolerance, they're probably going to misuse it, then why do we even go down that road to begin with? And of course there's reasons for it, and I understand that, but is it reasonable to expect that, you know, you're not going to have bad drug tests every now and then?
The analogy I use in talking with doctors, one of the patients I will see this afternoon is a, how old is she, mid-40s, I think. She has type 1 diabetes. And she gets admitted to a hospital, used to be about once a month, with diabetic ketoacidosis. And what we do now, at least Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, yeah, I would love it if Rhonda would just work 24/7. But what this patient does, when she checks her sugar and her meter just reads high, and that does not mean hello, that means it's over 600. She'll call Rhonda, and Rhonda will tell her, give yourself an extra 20 units of Humalog and drink some orange juice and call me back in an hour and a half. And Rhonda has worked this patient through, I am sure, diabetic ketoacidosis over the phone many times. She's been admitted with diabetic ketoacidosis 2 or 3 times in the past year. Now, I tell that story because if she comes in and her blood sugar is 600, I don't say, well, you know, we have this contract. You're not controlling your diabetes, so I won't be your doctor anymore. Goodbye. What do? We see her more often. We work with her a lot more. Rhonda will call her preemptively, probably once a week for a while. How are you doing? Are you following your diet? Have you connected with the diabetes center specialist yet? I mean, she's canceled and not shown up for several of their appointments. We redouble our efforts. And so when a patient has dirty urine, we don't kick them out of the practice. We say, well, you know, I'm not sure that continuing your OxyContin is safe, so I'm going to need to taper you off of that, but I'm not going to stop treating you. I still want to see you. And that, by the way, is where being Suboxone certified is a wonderful exit strategy. Because if somebody is misusing opioids, somebody that I'm treating for chronic pain with opioids, then I say, well, you know, I don't think that OxyContin is going to be a good drug for you, but what about Suboxone?
She had her hand up here first, and this is good enough.
So the one thing that I think this highlights for me is that our current model of care is not appropriate. It's too little time and not enough teamwork. So, you know, with the effort, at least in our clinic, we started doing team care. And I think there needs to be more and more of this along the chronic care model where you involve behavioral health specialists, you involve the nurse, you involve the MA, and you do more teamwork around those frequent visits and things that are steps or skills to support the patient.
Amen.
So actually what I was going to say was kind of on the line with her, that we just, money is also a driver in the primary care setting. So when you have people like, you know, I'm on the grants, but I see folks that don't cost, but I have more time to give. When that goes away, there's no one to pick up those services. And we see a lot of people who come in, and they want like to get their money's worth for their $10, $15, $20 copay. So if they could come in and get like see the dietitian, get their mammogram, they want to do everything at once to get the benefit of their money. But oftentimes the primary care person's so busy, we're like, chief complaint one, maybe two, but you gotta come back for three or four because I don't have time. Where when you had, if you had like a behavioral health consultant that could come in that was also educated in other fields, you know, I can talk to you about your weight loss. I can talk to you about your exercise program. I can help monitor those kind of things. But your physician's going to give you your cardiac medicine or your diabetes medicine. But I'm going to work with you on the rest of the stuff. Then yeah, we can take care of them as a whole.
Yeah, you know, the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, how many of you have read Section 2703 of the Affordable Care Act? Oh, good. At least two of you have. I can understand why no member of Congress read the whole thing. 1800, I don't know. Section 2703 sets up the patient-centered health home that Medicaid, Missouri Medicaid, bless their creativity, they've gotten into. We know that if we restructure primary care, it can deliver more. If we give primary care clinicians, nurse practitioners, physicians, more time per visit, if we increase the team, we provide mental health consultants on the team, nurse partners on the team, if we train LPNs and medical office assistants so that they practice to the top of their license, we can improve patient outcomes, improve quality, improve patient satisfaction and provider satisfaction, and lower costs. We know that can be done. We know how to do it. We're not there yet. That's an understatement. But you all are part of the solution. Did you know that? You are. So I celebrate you and I thank you for what you're doing.
Other questions? Well, I just had a brief comment to say that a friend of mine is a cardiologist who really understands motivational interviewing and the importance of it in cardiac rehab.
A cardiologist?
Yeah, yeah, he's pretty amazing. What he basically has come up with is he said, you know, a lot of doctors want their patients to comply. And that word is like they want to force their will on the patient. And I think the case that you brought up speaks to that, that it's really like when this patient still takes opiates, they're non-compliant, we're going to get rid of them, they're wasting our time. Whereas with diabetes and these other disorders, they want their patients to sort of adhere to these behavioral regimens to get better, and they think of adherence. And it is funny how the addiction, you know, it's almost like the person is insulting that practice if they have some addictive tendencies around these substances versus if they have other disorders and they're not adhering to their, you know what I mean, they're like softer about it. So I do think it's a cultural shift, and the teaming will help, but somehow, you know, they just need more empathy for those patients, and when they see it as a medical disease that can be treated with medications effectively, maybe we'll make that shift and take that term away. Just like Bill Miller has said, he hates that term, dirty urine. He just he told me that the other day. He's like, I don't like that term. Why do people use that? It's just so horrible, you know. And it's again, it's another cultural thing. It's like, and if we pervade that as healthcare, and I'm guilty of it because that's what I was taught in the 17th of the VA hospital. That's how patients speak in other programs. But really, if we want to change the culture, we need to start to use words that are really value laden that have empathy. So I would start, you know, people are talking about compliance, saying, no, I don't talk like that because I'm not trying to overrule the collaboration with this person. I want them to buy into this regimen for themselves. And if they adhere better to it, we're going to keep seeing them. We might not prescribe the med that they're using to get high because it's not going to benefit their health, but we still want to treat them. I like it.
Yeah. So,
tainted urine compromise here. You really do have to make both of this thing. What would you call it instead?
I mean, I think he might have used the term positive and negative, extreme, but, you know, I think you just have to be careful about your own words if we're trying to change the culture. And it's easy not to be, because we're all still part of that system.
Yeah.
You know, you talked about the shifts in thinking. With the new DSM coming out, they have the ICD codes in there, you know. So do you think that it is possible that the shift in mental health and the way they're thinking about things is more going towards the medical model?
Oh, yeah. Where DSM-5 is going to end up, there are a couple of things I like about DSM-5. It now links substance use, abuse, and dependence into one disorder, which makes scientific sense. One of the alcohol dependence criteria, inability to cut down, is one of the earliest in the life course of alcohol addiction. And one of the alcohol abuse criteria, legal trouble, is about the last to develop. And if you look at, you know, screening positive of the alcohol use disorder criteria for DSM-4 across a large national sample, 43,000 people in NESARC. I have that data set if you want to see it.
Oh, yeah.
It's in there. They don't form two groups like abuse and dependence. So it's all one thing. And second, I like DSM-5. They got rid of tolerance and withdrawal as criteria for substance use disorder. A patient that I am treating for chronic pain, if they stop taking their opioid, they are going to have withdrawal. They are not addicted. And I have had real problems getting that point across to some of them. Who else wants to talk? I'll get to you, and then I'll come over there. Don't forget me.
I have two comments and questions. One is,
the 30-year, and I think our head doctor did think that it's illegal. Situation where like the high blood pressure medicine and things like that is that kind of situation. So like not having in your urine what you're supposed to have in your urine or having an illegal substance, that he sees that as a legal issue, and that's why we were dismissing patients. So I didn't know what you could say to someone about that. And then my other one is this former doctor not to use any of these medications because of worrying about being sued. I'm worrying about the risks of it. And we had this seminar kind of at St. Louis where he gave us the pharmaceutical handbook, and I took it back and tried to educate him. And that's what he was saying. He's like, you're asking me to take a risk. I wasn't qualified to educate him on it. It's that kind of
thing. Yeah, try to set it up. I'll be happy to come talk. I am going to retire in 36 days.
Whoa.
But who's counting, you know? There are medications for that. You know, and 3 days later, I come back to work 40%. So I'm not going to stop my addiction medicine practice. But I hope to have more time. And one of the things I would love to do, honest, I would like to travel around the state to federally qualified health centers, to hospital ERs, to medical staff, to whatever. And do this talk or whatever folks would like to hear. Because what's delightful? The opportunity, like with buprenorphine, you know, that is a wonder drug. The number needed to treat of 2.5. I mean, I can't think of anything else that has that small a number needed to treat that we do all the time. I guess an appendectomy has a number needed to treat it 1. If you take the appendix out, they won't get appendicitis. But, you know, thank you. You have given me my life back. Just thinking about that, I get tears in my eyes. Although I always say, I have the easy job. All I have to do is write prescriptions. It's an easy drug to prescribe, it really is. And I say to the patient, you are doing the hard work of staying in recovery, and you're doing it well. Who over here had a...
I'm sure some people are aware, but Missouri is the only state that doesn't have the prescription drug monitoring program.
Yes.
And I'm from Northwest Missouri, so it's our legislature, you have to thank, our legislator, you have to thank for that. Does anyone know what efforts are being made? Because I think our physicians would be more comfortable if there was one cohesive place we could go to know, has someone been diverting medications? And right now it's an extensive time battle, and we still don't know.
Yeah, I could dream on. I would love to have a nationwide controlled drug monitoring program. It's got to work almost in real time. It's got to be really easy. I asked our pharmacist, you know, they have to track pseudoephedrine purchases, OTC. And I said, you know, how do you do that? And she said, oh, it's easy. We just ask the patient for their driver's license. We scan the barcode. Didn't even know driver's licenses had such. And then we scan the barcode on the package that they're purchasing, and we hit enter, and it's done. You know, why not?
And I think that makes our state a target, because we're the only one that doesn't have that.
Right, yeah. What you need to do with that state senator is take him lots of OxyContin fairly often. Yeah, Bruce, let me get you the
right. So we can know that everybody's doing screening at some level in their health centers now. But we need to know how we can help you bring this more to the forefront in your practices. What can we do as outsiders? help your doctors become more aware or whatever that's needed in the organization.
Well, and even with what I said before, one of the things, and it's still problematic in our clinics about patients being dismissed, but I do think that this has started the process of questions. You know, I think prior to this starting, I don't think the doctors even asked themselves those questions. This was just how business was done. I think they're open to information. They're open to suggestions. I think they would like to provide good care. I think it's just a matter of, but they're so busy. How to get the information to them? I don't have a clue.
Well, it just occurred to me is that something that JCO should help with by making a requirement for doctors to get educated? They help?
Yeah, and I hope that the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations, which now has substitute screening sort of as an optional little gold star, I'm hoping that they will make it required, because when JCO says, you will, you know, one reason that we got into this epidemic of opioid misuse, and the CDC calls it an epidemic, and I don't think the CDC uses the word epidemic lightly, but one reason we got into that was JCO said, you will ask every patient, every visit, how bad is your pain? And, oh, you've got bad pain. Oh, I've got to do something about that. Oh, well, the only thing I know to do is to give you some Percocet. And the history is written. But if JCO makes it a requirement, or if the National Council on Quality Assurance, I think is what NCQA stands for, but if you jump through some of their hoops, you get brownie points with CMS, you get more money. If they start making, addressing substance use, one of their criteria, then people will start doing it. And the issue about lawsuits, you know, my son-in-law is a lawyer, so I've got to be careful. How many lawyers does it take to teach anatomy? 37, as long as they're well embalmed. But I imagine that, yeah, I have a class of first-year medical students who 10 or 15 years ago collected the top 10 lawyer jokes and printed them on T-shirts. I wish I had bought one. But I don't want to think that lawsuits will drive healthcare, but they do. And when families start suing physicians, you saw him regularly for 3 years, and you never asked about his drinking. You never treated him for his drinking problem. And then he developed liver failure, and over a year, slowly died. Why didn't you treat him? We're going to sue you. Ooh, I don't want to think about that. I have been sued. It is an awful thing. It was more painful for me than the death of my father or my mother.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah. So is there any, are there any other, you know, questions around challenging? I mean, when Bruce originally was thinking of this too, it wasn't only going to be medication related. So we just want to make sure, is there any other questions around right now? Do you have patients that you're working with that are challenging you, and you wondered if you had, you know, questions about how to work with them in a manner that, you know, might be out of the box, or do you have any, you know, he called it the vexing patient. Is there any
if they have questions about that. Because, no, wait. Okay, so here's something just to say. Dan mentioned a couple of times when he was talking about medications, doing family work where he would have a spouse or a significant other, and he said a college friend or something, administer the medication. And it does turn out to be a significant aspect of some of those medications. And he said it sort of lightly that, you know, you make sure, but he meant it when he said, all you say is thank you for taking that. And what we know about this treatment, and the person that you should look up if you're interested in this treatment is a person by the name of Fowle Stewart. It's a two-word name, and that person did something called behavioral couples treatment. And they used a regimen like that, but there is a lesson on how you communicate and how the significant other communicates during those times, because it can be really tricky. And Dan's probably very effective at it because he just says with his authority, all you say is thank you, and don't say more than that, because what you're trying to do is keep it on the recovery, right? So I just wanted to make sure that people got that. That's really like it's an intervention sort of protocol. And really, doctors almost need to be trained in what they're doing, because if you didn't know to say that, you could sort of just let them say, yeah, just give them the medication, and you wouldn't tell them what to, how to do it. And it can get complicated, because then what happens is the person, if they feel, you know, a craving when you're on something like Anabuse is to not take Anabuse. Does that make sense? So you might not have craving to drink, but you have craving to not take your Anabuse, which is a sort of a... And so if that's the case, you know, you can expect that, and therefore this dialogue is really important, because the person wants to administer them their Anabuse and they really don't want to take it. And now you're trying to figure out how to motivate them to take it, because it really is only effective if they do take it, right? Particularly that medication, and probably a lot of these medications. So all that yet. No, I was just going to say.
I'm going to ask you both the final thoughts.
Yeah, well, one of my final thoughts is that, I mean, in mind, and that's why I bring this up, is that, you know, there are very effective psychosocial interventions. And I know Dan spoke about medical interventions. But this grant, hopefully, has brought to this state two very well-known interventions. And Dan was sort of adding another one when he brought in the significant other treatment. But motivational interviewing and cognitive behavior skills-based treatment. So you couple that with medicine, and it can be really potent. And, you know, I'm hopeful about all this, because I feel like the more that you screen, the more that this comes out, the more that we change the culture, it's a hopeful thought, not a really bad one, like doctors don't know. It's more, when will this happen? And it seems like the Medicaid systems and the billing systems can also open up an opportunity to have this happen more. And in the talks that we're going to have in the next day, I guess at this point, are really going to discuss, you know, how can we take this expert learning opportunity that you've now had for the years that you've been involved in the grant and actually expand on it. So I think this hope will be sort of the theme that carries through the next day and a half.
Yeah, I have many final thoughts. I think the main one is thank you, because what you all do means a lot. Yeah, we physicians haven't yet learned how to be team players, but I am convinced that trying to practice family medicine, at least, without people like Catherine and Toby and Rhonda right at hand, is like trying to play baseball without a first baseman or a catcher. Maybe not even a pitcher. And yes, Wynn, thank you for reminding me of couples therapy. I can think of several folks where couples are needed. And with the Mosberg grant funding ends, and some of you are even now looking for your next job, I wish you well. We need you. We really need you.
in our society. These are common, serious, expensive, deadly problems. And even though they are usually hidden, they are treatable. Thank you.